I'm Ross Mitchell from the University of Calgary, and I was asked to come and talk to you about optimization, which after talking to Yuri, I interpreted to mean co-registration. That's one of the main areas where we're applying optimization in our research. So a brief outline. I'm going to talk a little bit about what is 3D alignment. In medicine, we often call this co-registration or registration, and I'll talk in some detail about the two major types, rigid, nonlinear, and then onto some future work. So 3D alignment or 3D co-registration is an important task in many areas of science, not just medicine. It's used in geophysics. In the oil patch out in Calgary, they use it a lot when they pump oil out of the ground. It actually changes the aquifer underneath and can change the structure of the ground, and repeated seismic imaging of the same patch of land can tell you about the potential reserves of oil in that area. So it's a pretty important thing in the oil sector. In molecular biology, if you have very high resolution imaging like electron microscopy or some single photon type computed tomographies, you can actually look inside a single cell, and the distribution of the organelles or sometimes even the genes in that cell can tell you something about the proteomics and the types of proteins that are being produced. So it's actually being used there. In ecology, satellite remote sensing in particular, they use it to monitor changes in the Earth over time. And in medicine, you saw a number of applications. And it turns out that all these fields are doing work in parallel, and they all have different language when they describe these algorithms. But if you sort of put them all together, it turns out that they all fall into a couple of categories, which we'll talk about. So what do we mean by alignment? Well, here's an example. This is a patient who's it's the same person imaged on the same day, and in the yellow here is the CT scan, and in the red is an MRI scan. This particular patient has had a stroke, and the reason they received both CT and MR right after each other was the CT provides good information about the blood vessels in the brain. The patient's had an injection of contrast agent. The blood vessels show up bright in the CT. The MR gives you information about the soft tissue in the brain, like Drew showed just a few moments ago. In the spine, it's also the same sort of thing in the brain. So the soft tissue damage is revealed by the MRI, and the blood vessels, presumably one of them is clogged, causing the soft tissue damage. That information is provided by the CT. If you can fuse them together, you get a better picture of what's going on. So how do you go about fusing data? Well, one of the most common ways is to use an external frame. This is called a fiducial frame, and it's placed on top of the head, and some of them, this one for example, is loose, if you will. Some of them are actually screwed into the skull. If you're doing brain imaging other parts of the body, they'll use other techniques. And if you're in a hospital, you'll sometimes see patients going around, they're at the cafeteria and they have this huge frame and it's literally screwed into their head. They have local anesthesia applied so it doesn't hurt, but it's quite an awkward thing to be carrying around. And it has to be carefully designed so that it's visible in multiple modalities. So you can see bars here with various wires. These are actually tubes that are filled with a contrast agent that's visible both in MR and CT, or CT and PET, or MR and PET. So the patient can go from scanner to scanner, and you have a reference frame that you can use to align the images afterwards. So if the patient is scanned axially, that means cross-sectionally like this through the body, which most imaging modalities do, if we drew a line here just above the level of the eyes and pulled an image out, it might look something like this. And you can see this is an MRI of this patient, and this has all these white dots. Well, these are the locations in the frame cut in cross-section from the scan, and you can see them appearing as an oval shape. If you find the center of mass of each of these, and you know a priori the geometry of this frame, you can figure out exactly where the slice is and its orientation in 3D. And you can see there's a lot of points in here, so you have an overdetermined system which gives you some tolerance to noise, and you're in precision to specify exactly the center of that tube. So if you have a patient who's, say, scanned twice, either the same modality or different modalities at two different points in time, and they're wearing this frame, this could be a PET scan or a second MRI, then by finding correspondence between points in the adjacent frames, again, you've got a lot of these points, you've got an overdetermined system, and you can come up with a coordinate transformation matrix that you can apply to the second image to bring it in to alignment with the first image. So that's how a lot of co-registration is done for medical applications. But there are a number of drawbacks, particularly that frame. So what do you do if you have no external landmarks, if you have no frame? And this is actually quite often the case in medical imaging. Patients, if we know ahead of time, if you're doing surgical planning, for example, in our clinic, when they're doing deep brain surgery, that's when they will put a fiducial frame on. But for brain cancer, for example, regular screening and planning, they don't actually use a frame. And for most of the cancers, they don't actually use a frame. And in stroke, they don't have time to put the frame on. And in a lot of other diseases, the frame is too bulky or gets in the way and makes the scanning more difficult. So if you don't have a frame, then you're pretty much left with using information in the images to do the alignment. And I'm just going to show you this schematically here. If we have two different imaging modalities, one in yellow and one in blue, they're of the same patient and they're acquired either in different points in time or different imaging modalities, and there's a misregistration between the two, what we'll do is we'll make some kind of an attempt to use the information in the images and iterate and move one image over the second image, and use the information, for example, the edges of the grayscale value in the images, to try and iteratively bring those images into alignment. So here's an example. This is an actual patient who has a brain tumor. This is a native brain tumor. It's not from the lung. It's actually caused by cells native to the brain. And it turns out that this corner closest to you in this view is the actual tumor. And this is showing two scans, one pre-op, before the tumor was removed, in the red channel, and the post-op scan of the same patient in the green channel. And you can see through these orthogonal cuts through the data that there's clearly a misalignment. What I showed you previously on the last slide was misalignment and correction in 2D, but that almost never works in actual clinical practice. We almost always have misalignment in 3D, as is the case with this patient here. So what we'd like to do is to use information inherent in the data set. There is no frame on this patient, for example, to try and bring these into alignment. You can see after this operation is completed that we're much better aligned here. And if you look at this closely, the different colors here actually correspond or provide some information about the volume of tissue that was removed and the volume of tissue that's moved into the void that was created after removing the tumor. So you have to extend this another dimension, add another spatial dimension to it, and this makes the problem exponentially more difficult. It's enormous. If these two volumes, they could be 100 megabytes apiece, and you've got to go through and jiggle one and try and make it line up and try and measure information content at every location at every step, the number of computations are absolutely enormous. So I'll go through this in a little bit more detail, but it turns out this whole problem is really an optimization problem. That's part of one of the reasons why I was interested to come and speak here, is to get sort of get some feedback on the optimization techniques that we use. We're sort of a jack of all trades, master of none, and for certain we're not optimization experts by any means. So if we look at this task, the overall goal is to take, let's say we have two images. We want to take one of these images, we'll call it the moving image, and bring it into alignment with the fixed image. This involves four steps. The basic algorithm is four steps. First, you apply a transformation. In this case, we'll call it a rigid transformation. It could be an affine transformation. It could actually be a full nonlinear transformation. We'll start initially with a rigid body transformation, a scaling and a rotation and a translation. Once we've done that, we have to resample the original volume onto the same grid spacing as the target volume. So there's a resampling step involved. After we've done that, we can compare the two volumes voxel by voxel and come up with a measure of goodness, of fit, or how close they are, a measure of similarity. Once we've done that, we can pass that off to our optimizer, which will produce a new set of parameters by stepping through the parameter space. And that set of parameters is a new, in this case, 4x4 transformation matrix, if we're doing an affine transformation, and we'll apply that to the volume again. And you literally repeat this hundreds, typically hundreds if not thousands of times. And if you consider that, say, this volume is 100 megabytes and this is 100 megabytes, you can imagine the computations involved. Enormous computations doing all these steps. And you notice that this is where the bandwidth is high, I've indicated here. And actually, the information passing to and from the optimizer is relatively low compared to the volume involved in these other three steps. So we're moving a lot of data around, and that's one of the major issues that slows the algorithm down. So we decided to tackle this by harnessing the power of GPUs. Most of you are probably familiar with GPUs and what's been going on in the last decade with their computing power. They've vastly outstripped the rate of increase of CPUs in terms of their computational power. And what's driving it? Well, this industry. And I put this particular title up because it's quite interesting. This was released last summer, and it set an all-time entertainment record. I don't know how many of you are familiar, but the video game industry in 2002 surpassed Hollywood as the biggest entertainment industry on the planet. The revenues from video game sales have continued to grow. They're larger than all revenue from all movies combined since 2002, and the gap is just growing since then. So this is the single... probably up until this next summer coming up, this has been the single largest entertainment product in the history of humanity, this video game. In its first day, it did $310 million of business, and in the first week, it did $500 million of business. No Hollywood movies ever even come close. It's a big deal. And what happens when they build a better game is you've got to get a better graphics card. Anybody who has a teenage son knows this. They're coming to you every 6 months saying, "Mom, Dad, I can't play the latest game that my friend down the street has. I need a new one of these. It's only going to cost you $300 or $400. And you buy them the game, and the next summer a new game comes out and they need another video card. So they just keep leapfrogging each other. The two major companies, AMD and NVIDIA, are combined spending $5 to $10 billion a year on R&D pushing this technology forward. This is one of the current ones you can buy. This actually has 800 processors on board, each of them running at 750 megahertz, has a gig of very fast RAM, and they rate this at a teraflop, 10 to the 12 floating point calculations per second. And this kind of compute power you can get for the princely sum of $300. This is what it costs to get a teraflop inside your PC. For comparison about just how dramatically these machines have increased in compute power, this is what a teraflop looked like 10 years ago. This was the first computer in the world to pass this barrier, the ASCII Red in Sandia National Labs, where it was used for atomic bomb testing. It's classified, but estimated to have cost $200 million to build, including its own power substation, and occupied a floor area the size of two tennis courts. So in 10 years, you've gone from that to a $300 card you can put in your PC. There's no CPU on the planet that's made this kind of progress in the last decade. These machines, not these ones, the one from the previous page, are going to change the way we do computing. There's absolutely no question about it. They're just so vastly outpacing the growth of CPUs. And the major chip companies like Intel, for one, know it, and they're adapting and changing their strategies. So what we managed to do in my lab is implement these three components of this four-step algorithm entirely on the graphics card. So the two volumes are downloaded and stored as textures. Textures are used a lot in video games, so when you smash the brick wall, you can see the interior of the brick, or you cut into the tree, you can see some of the wood. So the reason why these have more and more RAM all the time is that the video game developers can upload and store more textures. We use them to store the medical image volumes, and a typical card now will have a gigabyte of RAM. You can store two fairly large medical volumes on it. As a rule of thumb, when you're developing on a modern OS like Windows, Vista, or Mac OS, you get about half of the video RAM available for your use. The system reserves the other half to do all the fancy graphics that you expect now in a modern OS, in terms of opaque and transparent windows and moving them around smoothly. And we also use the fragment and vertex shaders, or in more current terminology, they're just a general purpose shader, and we implemented the transform. The resample is implemented in hardware. We've implemented higher order resampling techniques to get better results, and importantly, we've implemented a variety of similarity metrics on the GPU. We had to leave the optimizer on the CPU because, as far as we're aware, and this is a question for you folks in the audience, there's not a really good way to parallelize this. It would be very interesting to try and move this onto here as well. But for now, this works pretty well because there's the bandwidth or the amount of data traveling to and from the CPU is quite small, and it's not really a limiting step. So that's sort of an overview of co-registration. I'm going to talk a little bit about rigid registration and some of the work that we've done for this. So I'll just start with a demo. Here's a tool that we have in my lab, and this is running on my iMac at home. It's not a new iMac. This is a pretty old graphics card now. We'll let it run through here. This is a patient scanned about 6 months apart. The patient has multiple sclerosis, and there are two MRIs of their brain. Each MRI has been upsampled to 256 cube, just to give the graphics card a bit more work to do. And you can see the two scans are loaded in red and green, and they're clearly misaligned, and the misalignment is in 3D. When I go down and click on the start button, I'll click reset in a second here. So they're misaligned here. When I click on the start button, you're actually going to see the similarity metric calculated and displayed. It's on a GPU, so we can show it to you in real time. So that's how long it takes now to do a rigid co-registration of two 256 cube volumes. Each data set is about 50 megabytes in this case. So 100 megabytes of data could be co-registered on a very inexpensive graphics card now in just a matter of seconds. So this is interesting. This is an article that came out about a year and a half ago now in the Wall Street Journal talking about the Mayo Clinic and IBM made a significant advance in medical imaging, real-time medical imaging. And what they're actually talking about is what you just saw, computer-enhanced alignment of medical images to do things like track changes in lesions over time in response to therapy or maybe for diagnostic purposes. And they used the cell system, IBM Cell Blade. They used a number of those, and they implemented the algorithm on the cell. And actually, a team at IBM did this. The Mayo Clinic provided the data, so they had a group at IBM implementing this algorithm on the cell. But what got everybody really excited was their claim that they can do this alignment now in no more than 20 seconds with any of these volumes. Well, you just saw it running, a movie of it running on my iMac on an old video card in way under 20 seconds, and I didn't need an IBM Cell supercomputer to do it. In fact, a $100, $50 graphics card will do it. On current graphics cards, well, that video that you saw, if I ran it on a $100 graphics card and an 8800 class graphics card, it takes about a second to complete. So you can just see how fast they're ramping up. I had people from all over North America emailing me this, saying, have you seen this? This is amazing. Can you believe it? And I just had to bite my tongue because we already had it running on the graphics cards at that time in well under 20 seconds. So it runs fast, but does it make any difference? You could be making good time, but totally lost, so to speak. What really counts not only is the speed, but the accuracy. So we've done a number of experiments, and this is an interesting data set, the Retrospective Image Registration Evaluation Project. It's a public domain data set. You can sign up, get an account with them for free, and then download the data. And what they've done is they had a number of patients who actually had those fiducial frames attached to their heads, and they were in for a variety of disorders. And these patients all had two different imaging modalities on the same day. They all had MR. They either had an additional PET or an additional CT in addition to their MR. And so what they did is they collected all this data, and then they sat down and they edited out the fiducial marker. So they knew the truth from the fiducial frame. That gave them their ground truth. They edited out the fiducial frame and posted the data, anonymized it, and posted it online, and you can download it. So once you download it, you can apply any algorithm you want, do your alignment, and then you upload your transformation matrix. So this is a rigid co-registration. And they evaluate your transformation matrix and compare it to the true co-registration from the frame, and then they post your errors online. It's an automated process. You can go compare how well you're doing to everybody else in the world who's working on co-registration algorithms. So this is sort of what it looks like. This is a CT to MR and PET to MR and before and after the co-registration. Let's look at this in a little more detail. So here's an MR and a CT before co-registration. These are our actual results, and this is what it looks like after we're done with the co-registration. So visually it looks pretty good. You can see the eyes are lined up, the brain is lined up. And PET MR, now the PET is in green in this instance. You can see the PET is a lower spatial resolution. There's a large mass here. So these weren't normal patients. These were patients like really in the hospital for a real process. This particular patient has a large brain tumor, this bright mass right there. Before the co-registration and after the co-registration, you can see they're lined up pretty well. And when we posted our results online, this is the accuracy that we were getting. The red dash here indicates the voxel size of the coarser data set. So you can see this is the co-registration from PET to MR. The PET voxels are quite large. They're about 2.5 millimeters in one linear dimension. We're getting accuracies that are roughly on par with the voxel size. And CT to MR, in this case, the MR voxel size is 1.25 millimeters on a side. The CTs are smaller. So basically, we're getting accuracies on par with the in-plane resolution of the coarser data set, which is about what you'd expect. So, you know, around 3 millimeters in the case of PET and about 1.25 millimeters in the case of CT to MR. And how does this compare? Well, approximately equal to the in-plane spacing of the coarser data set, but when we checked, we had the fourth most accurate results yet posted on the site. There's about 200 different groups around the world who posted their results. So we're in fourth place, and they don't actually record how long it takes to do the co-registration, but the groups are there, so we did a lit search on them and found the publications that described their algorithms, and the group that was above us and below us each took over an hour to perform the alignment. Per patient. It's 1 hour of computation on a current generation processor. So how long did we take to do it? Well, here's our alignment time in seconds. It took about 3.5 seconds to do the PET to the MR because the PET is coarse, and about 10 seconds to do the CT to the MR. So we're in the ballpark with algorithms that were taking an hour of computation time, and we're doing it in 10 seconds or less. So this is the difference between it being used in the clinic and it not being used in the clinic. The docs are not going to wait an hour for an alignment to take place. But we also decided to compare it to some more commonly used co-registration tools. Those algorithms that were posted on that website were very specialized, and the people put a lot of time and effort into tuning them for that specific application. These are used more generally throughout medical imaging and medical image processing. FLIRT was developed in Oxford. ITK stands for the Insight Segmentation and Registration Toolkit. It has a large number of algorithms for segmenting and co-registering data sets. This is pretty much the standard that most people use now. And AIR was developed at UCLA for brain alignment. FLIRT is used a lot by the functional MRI community. It's part of this is in the SPM package, and they use it to do alignment there. So if you compare our rigid co-registration, CT to CT or MR to MR, about 8 seconds on average, and if you're doing multimodal, around 12 seconds, so similar to what we had seen before. And the other algorithms were at least, you know, were a factor of 10 to 40 times faster than the other open source algorithms that you can use. This technology is a couple years old now, so you can just cut the times down accordingly. So rigid registration is actually, I feel, the low-hanging fruit for medical applications. There's lots of things that can be done. And if you can do the co-registration in a few seconds, you can do things like what we are doing in the lab. We're building this into the database system, essentially, the doctors use to browse the images acquired of a patient's image in the hospital. It's called a Picture Archiving and Communication System, or a PACS. And it's just basically a big database. When you go in and you have a patient to look at, you're a radiologist, and you know that Mrs. Smith came in last night and was scanned, you'll come in the morning and type in Mrs. Smith, and you'll see her scan from last night, but probably 9 times out of 10, she's been scanned in the previous 6 months, or she's in the cache that's in the database. You usually keep about a year online. And so those previous scans show up in the list too. So now we have the possibility of having the system say to the doc, would you like me to align those for you? And the doc says yes, and it only takes a couple of seconds and they're done, because it's the same patient. So we know we can do a rigid registration. So that's something we'd like to see. We're working to bring that into a clinical practice. But nonlinear alignment is also a really important thing. And you use it, for example, when you have image distortion. This happens a lot in MRI. It's a very nonlinear image acquisition process, and you often get distortions caused by physiology or artifacts, objects in the body, or nonlinear movement, and Drew was talking about this extensively, during surgery or radiotherapy. Sometimes you want to combine images from many patients. If you're doing a clinical trial, you'd like to have a population average or a description of what's going on in a population, so that's very useful. And also you can warp what's called an atlas, and I'll talk about this in a little bit more detail, to fit an individual, and this is for segmentation. So this is an example of an atlas. This is one that's commonly available, again open source, you can download it. And a human expert actually sat down and outlined structures in the brain, and there are atlases for various other organs, but the brain has had the most attention for atlases. So a human neuroanatomist actually sat down and outlined and labeled all these structures cross-sectionally, slice by slice, through a very, very high resolution MRI scan of this person's brain. And once you've got that data outlined cross-sectionally like this, of course, you can cut through it in any orientation and see the labeled structures any way you want. Very useful for teaching purposes, just this alone. And you can render it in 3D and rotate it around and look at it. So what we'd like to be able to do is to take this and put it on a different individual. And to do that, what we'll do is we'll non-linearly warp the source brain to fit the target brain, and once we figure out that set of deformations, we'll apply it to these polygons essentially and bring them along for the ride. So here's an example. This is the atlas, a cross-section, a single cross-section with just a single contour. This is the surface of the brain, for example, and here it is outlined in the original atlas on the original MRI scan. And here it is transported over to an individual that was scanned in our clinic, and the cyan or light blue is the original line off of the atlas, and the yellow line is after we've applied our nonlinear transformation to try and bring it into alignment. And I'll just zoom that up a bit so you can see the difference sort of before and after the alignment. So you can get a pretty good alignment. It's not perfect, but it's not bad for a deep brain structure like the ventricles here. So how do you do it? Well, it's an entirely different process than the rigid co-registration. There are many different ways to do it, but one of the preferred ways to do it is actually to set down a lattice of points on both the source image and the target image. And then what you do essentially in the second image is at each control point you search in the local vicinity for a region that's similar to that in the source image. So you do a hunt. So you're doing an optimization on three parameters. It's location in 3D space. You've got an X, Y, and Z coordinate. And you have to do that for each of these points. And depending on the algorithm, these points may apply forces to adjacent nodes around them. So you can constrain it so you don't get twisting and knots and overlapping of control points, typically done. And you can use, if you know physical properties of the tissue, for example, if you know that this is a piece of white matter and this is a piece of gray matter and they have different physical properties, you can constrain them that way as well. And that's one of the reasons why this type of approach is preferred. So you can imagine you've got X, Y, and Z coordinate at each node, and typically to get a good result, you will have thousands of nodes, and this can lead to hundreds of thousands of parameters to try and optimize across. When you've actually figured out this deformation grid, if you have a point in the source image that doesn't map nicely onto one of these nodes, what you do is you interpolate a vector field. So for each location in here, you basically create a vector and you apply that as a force. And the way you do is you look up into here, interpolate the vector field, displace that according to the vector field, and then use that to map onto the appropriate place in the output image. And that's how you do the deformation. So you basically have to go through this lookup table as an intermediate step. So now we've increased our optimization problem orders of magnitude. We've gone from optimizing 6, 9, maybe 12 parameters to trying to optimize perhaps 100,000 parameters. So this is what we did. Our optimizer is running on the CPU. So what we did is we took our lattice grid and we broke it up into adjacent overlapping subfields to optimize over. And if your machine has four processors in it, we would split it four ways and run an optimizer on each thread essentially, and it would try and optimize a subset. Then you have to do some reconciliation at the end, and there's a lot of overhead, especially if you've got forces being transmitted between adjacent nodes. It can slow it down a lot. So that's what we did. So we have a threaded parallel optimizer running on the CPU, but it's not ideal in the sense that we have limited communication between nodes and we aren't optimizing across all the parameter space simultaneously. But it works. So here's an example. This is a known data set, and we applied known nonlinear transformations to it. And here's an example of the original image, the grid. This is an applied transformation. It's a three-dimensional sine wave through the data, and you can see how that affects the grid and what the resulting image looks like. This is a local deformation. It's a contraction here. You can see it's sort of a pulling in and an expansion here. And this is a combination of the two. So you've got a three-dimensional sine wave going through the data with a contraction here and an expansion there. So there's no real good model yet of how the brain deforms under surgery or radiotherapy. So most of the research uses known very nasty transformations like this in an attempt to recover. So what we would do is then we'd end up with an image like this and we would try and apply our nonlinear transformation to make it look like that. And I can show you the results, but basically the output image looks like that. And the residual error is pretty small visually, so you have to really look at it quantitatively, which is what we did. And this is typically what we get. Our alignment accuracy expressed in millimeters of absolute error. And in this case, the voxel size is 1 cubic millimeter in this data set. So the blue bars represent the error before we've applied our co-registration. So here's the local error. This is the contraction and expansion. Here's the sine wave running through the data in 3D, and this is both. And after we've applied our algorithm, we're getting back onto the order of the inherent resolution in the data set, which is pretty good. You might be able to do a little bit better than that, but you're not going to do significantly better than the limit of the spatial resolution of the data set. So we're pretty confident that in a nasty distortion like that, we can correct it. So if there was a local distortion, say a mass effect from a brain tumor growing, we could model that with a local deformation. Changes that are happening, say, across the lung, like Drew was talking about, might include both a local deformation, because the tumor is changing and the lung is moving, a more global. So that might be the worst case here. That's great, but how long did it take? Well, the only really algorithm that we can compare it against was ITK. It's the only one we could get to consistently work, and it's kind of a silly comparison. This is minutes. This is 12 hours versus 2 minutes on the GPU, so a huge, huge difference in compute time. And so we say, well, this is fantastic. We're good to go, but this actually looks a lot like this. And I'm comparing our nonlinear warping on the GPU to our rigid warping on the GPU. And we would actually like to get this down to here. We'd actually like to get this down to 30 frames a second so we can do it in actual real time. So yes, it's better than 12 hours, but we'd like to get it down to there if possible. And how do we get there? Well, this algorithm that I talked about before, only these three parts run on the GPU. We wonder if there's a way to speed this up by making this GPU enabled. Other groups are doing this by spreading this computational load across a cluster and they can get good acceleration. But it'd be very nice if you could do it on a graphics card because you don't need to maintain a cluster. It's just a simple single device. And that's sort of the things that we're going to be looking at in future work. Can we do the optimization better? We're not experts in optimization by any means. I haven't talked about the algorithms we use, but we typically use things like Need or simplex operators, very, very basic optimization algorithms. Can you optimize in parallel? And is it the type of parallelization you could do on the GPU? And we're also doing related research. We sped up the algorithm, but there's still a lot of fiddling involved on the user's part for picking parameters to make it work reliably. And so we're looking at machine learning techniques to help us pick algorithms more reliably. And with the new GPUs and the new architectures that are coming out, there's a lot of advances still to be made on the GPU software development. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions. Yes. Resampling is a big contributor, and there's been papers showing that different resampling algorithms can affect the error. In current state of the art, the resampling algorithm might get you another 25%, might reduce your error by 25% if you spend a lot more time and do very, very large kernels when you're doing your resampling. So an exponential increase in compute time for maybe 5, 10, maybe 20% in reduction.
There's probably no way to get about it there, right? Field step, you have to walk for the decision in the middle, you have to compile, and you're going to get the error about this.
Yeah, it's pretty tough, especially in nonlinear deformation, to expect that you'd get an error better than the resolution inherent in the data set. There's just no information below the spatial resolution the data was acquired in. You can't invent information when it's not there. The high spatial frequencies are just not there in the data. Yes?
What does the GPUs do that CPUs don't?
Well, you saw that card had 800 processors. That's one of the things they do. And the other thing they do is the memory is over 100 gigabytes a second of bandwidth. So, you know, that's an order of magnitude higher than even the current state-of-the-art PCs that are coming out this spring from Intel with their new architecture. They're expected to get around 10 gigabytes a second, maybe 15. We'll see. But the GPUs, now the limit to that is current state-of-the-art. NVIDIA has a GPU now that has 4 gigs of RAM on it, and they're coming out with one this spring that will have 8. But so you're limited to 4 or 8 gigs of RAM. Now, that's not bad. It wasn't too long ago we'd be very happy to have 4 or 8 gigs of RAM in our desktop PC. Well, you can get that now. That's about a $4,000 video card. But you know in 2 years that will be a $500 video card that will have that 4 gigs of RAM on it. So it's very special RAM, very high tolerance, very, very fast RAM.
Following on that, aren't there limitations, though, in the type of operations you can do?
Absolutely. Absolutely. GPU is, when I describe it to students, I say they're very, very simple to program. You program in a language that's essentially C. It's a very high-level language. It's really easy to write code that runs terribly on a GPU. Just about anything you do, it'll run, and it's slower than the CPU. To get it to run fast is a real trick. You got to really think differently. It's massively parallel. It's all out-of-order execution. You write a little kernel, if you think of it, and it'll run in parallel on 800 processors with no guarantee of when things complete. It might be processing this voxel and this voxel simultaneously and then do these two, and it just... so. And you have no access to that. And it's part of the beauty of the curse of programming on the GPU. That low level is all abstracted away, so it's easy to develop. But you have to, if you write the right kind of algorithm, it runs really fast, but it's hard to do. Yes?
In non-rigid registration, so when you do the deformation of the lattice, do you actually force this with the topological lattice, or you allow, or how do you prevent things from kind of crossing over?
No, it can happen, and it does happen if you don't put some kind of constraint on the adjacent nodes in the lattice.
How do you
Oh, you can actually put forces on the links between the nodes and the lattice. So there's an additional term in your optimal. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so we've done that in the rigid case with that Ryer test data set where they had the fiducial frame as the gold standard. For nonlinear deformation, it's pretty tough. There's no gold standard available. So pretty much all the literature that's published, and there's a vast amount of it, uses a technique similar to what we've done where they apply a known pretty aggressive nonlinear transformation and try and recover. You would hopefully never see anything that aggressive in a patient due to physiology. So the thought is if we can correct that to within and get back to the voxel type size errors, that we could do it for a pathological or physiological change. Yes? Yeah, that would be an ideal way to do it. You don't want to do 10 pairwise co-registrations. It's like doing, for those of you guys who are mathematicians, doing 10 pairwise t-tests is a no-no. You got to run an ANOVA and then do a post-hoc. get that all the time if you're a grad student in your thesis, and don't do more than two pairwise t-tests. Same thing in co-registration. You like to take all 10 volumes and use all the information instead of doing 20 or 30 pairwise co-registrations. What I would do would be, try and fit it on the graphics card. You can buy machines now, and we have some in the lab, and you can put like 4, 5, or 6 of these high-end graphics cards in them. But then you basically have a cluster inside a box, and you get problems with synchronization and coordination. If you can fit it all in a card with 8 gigs of RAM, it'd be ideal. I don't know. Most of them are fixed point. They're 12 bits of data. But all these calculations, one of the first things the GPUs do now is convert everything to floating point. The new GPUs have 128 bits of floating point precision. So I don't know, and it's interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with the Larrabee architecture that's coming out in a year or two, probably. You'll be buying PCs with 32 or 64 processors in them, and at the same time, you'll have a GPU in it that will have, like, now that you can get 1600 processors on one GPU. I think at some point, the RAM in your PC is just going to become an L3 cache, another level of cache for the GPU, and there'll be much better integration moving data between the two. So we're looking at things like, there's a company in Waterloo that makes a product called RapidMind that abstracts away the architecture. There's an open source platform called Brook and Brook Plus, and they abstract away this multi-core architecture. Basically, all this is multi-core, and it's coming. It's the future of computing, and Intel knows it. That's why they're going to Larrabee. And that's also the reason, I believe, why AMD purchased ATI. They already are, and there's new compiler technology, and Apple has it built into their next OS that's coming out this spring called Snow Leopard, that uses multi-threading all throughout the OS to actually schedule and control threads running on the GPU, and it actually monitors the execution time and decides whether that thread is better to run on the CPU or the GPU, and it does that dynamically. So a lot of that, I think the days of putting the MPI statements, here's something that can be parallelized, and what you need to do to efficiently parallelize is you have to tell it what can be parallelized, but then the next important thing is the data locality. Is it something that can sit local in a cache, or is it something that sits far away? And if you can provide those hints to the compiler, it looks like we'll be able to do a pretty good job of parallelizing it. So I think if you have to program MPI Beowulf style programming, it's not going to go anywhere. That's just too difficult. The average person isn't going to do that. Yes?
When you're doing the volumetric alignment, what are you, in the similarity metric, what are you comparing?
We have a whole bunch of different similarity metrics implemented, so you can just pick off a pop-down list. I can come and show it to you if you want, but we have mutual information running on the GPU. Normalized mutual information, a gradient-based method that was published about a year ago that is comparable to MI. Difference, absolute difference, correlation, a whole bunch of them. Yes?
How many design variables are you talking about in the optimization?
How many design variables?
How many parameters are you changing?
Well, if you look at the raw data set, we will put down a grid of 25 cubed, typically, nodes, and each of those has 3 parameters associated with it. So that's about 50,000 parameters that we're trying to optimize. 25 cubed times 3. In that case, it was a simplex.
Linear,
sequential simplex, yep. And we believe that's part of the reason why, even so, the resampling and all the calculations you get very quickly on the GPU, but we'll be spending most of our time in the optimizer now on the CPU trying to just step through all that. And we use a multi-resolution. I didn't talk about multi-resolution, so you do a coarse resolution at a much coarse alignment at a much coarser resolution, and once that's stabilized, you step and add more information and proceed and proceed. So you use four levels of resolution to step through the volume. Yes? I'm not really involved with Caveman at all, but I'm a principal investigator on pretty much all of the NeuroArm grants. Or not, a co-investigator. Dr. Garnett Sutherland's the principal investigator.
How close is Medford?
Pardon me?
How close is
Medford? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
How close are you to the medical application?
To medical applications? Quite close. So, I formed a company about 3 or 4 years ago called Calgary Scientific, and I think it was on my title slide. This technology has been transferred to Calgary Scientific, and it's in prototype versions there, and we have prototype applications that combine co-registration and segmentation, so you can snap volumes into alignment, and then it's primarily for cancer diagnosis where you segment a tumor and it does it across all time points simultaneously because they're all aligned. And we'll actually report, so you segment the tumor once and it tells you its volume and the change in volume over time. So we've got an application like that running in the lab. I could show you if it runs on the laptop. Calgary Scientific is building this into their products. It's in the pipeline.
I
don't. I know that they have got parts of... There are GPU implementations of BLAST. Yeah. No more questions? Well, thank you very much for having me.
Just a quick reminder, soon there'll be some snacks and light drinks or outside, usually inside of them, so if there's nothing, yeah, we'll take it out. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
It gives hope that it will be a bit of more.
I'm really interested in your field.
Oh, okay.
Enjoying your talk.
Oh, thank you.
Do you have any kind of well-posed optimization problems, you know, I'm an optimizer.
Okay. Well, co-registration was the first one that came to mind, and I alluded to it, but we have other ones as well.
And you want to deform into another line, whatever.
Yep.
Let's say you do it rigid.
Yep.
And so you're looking for the optimal parameters that would minimize some.
Minimize some metric. Right.
Is that written down anywhere?
Oh yeah, yes. We've got lots of work done on the four-step algorithm and each of those components and how they work, and about some of the details that we did for the implementation. But my guess is we're using optimization techniques right out of the 70s.